Good morning, everyone. Good morning. If I had a piece of glass here, I would hit it with a knife to try to collect everyone's attention. I am stuck with paper, so I will not do that, but I will welcome you all here and greet you for what I think will be a very, very exciting and interesting session. My name is James Fallows. I'm a writer with the Atlantic Monthly magazine. I have the honor of being surrounded by or being flanked by two of the people I have admired for a very, very long time in the technology world, and we have a chance to hear from them and ask questions, both mine and your own, about various aspects of the interaction between technology and economic development. I'm sure you know these people by reputation and probably by sight and probably by voice over the last couple of days at the Ideas Festival, but for the record, I'll introduce them once again. We have here John Seely Brown, now of the Annenberg School at USC, but for many, many years associated with Xerox and the Palo Alto Research Center, where he had enormous influence on all the technology we use and will use in the future. On my right is Bill Joy, now with Kleiner Perkins, but for many years with Sun, and a innovator, a writer, a visionary in the world of technology and its social interactions. So we're going to talk with them about the connection between the things they know by being such luminaries in their field and the things that all the rest of us are concerned about the way the developed world will continue its economic expansion, about whether the undeveloped world, the less developed world economically, will be able to join, what the impacts and the limitations are going to be environmentally, socially, et cetera, what the consequences of globalization might be. My experience from the other panels I've seen so far through the session is that most moderators, so savoring the chance to talk with these experts themselves, go too long in asking their own questions. And so I will try to confine myself to just a few introductory ones, and I'll start inviting your questions. One of the nice things about this festival is the concentration of involved, well-experienced, intelligent crowds that are in every room. So I will pretty soon switch to invite you to ask questions. I wanted to start with a survey question for each of our panelists in turn, just trying to set some of the parameters, again, things they know that we might not know. The overall topic here is the connection between technology and economic development. I'd like to ask first John Seely Brown and then Bill Joy to give us the big picture about the role of technology in three different ways, three different sort of connected, although and yet still separable, aspects of economic development. One is the highly developed world, the United States, Western Europe, developed East Asia. Do we think that we are just at the beginning of technology providing new bounty for the way we live, the way we produce, eliminating our barriers and problems, or what? What's the big picture about the developed world, about the less developed world, the things which are promising and less promising that you see coming for nations in Africa and other parts of the world that have been left out so far of the global economic boom, and then for the connective tissue of globalization, which issues you think will be coming on the horizon, driven by technology that will make the globalization trade-off seem either better, worse, or different in the future. So rich countries, poor countries, and the globalization that connects the two, how should we think about them based on what you know in the technical world? Nice, easy lead-off question.
Yeah. Bill, you want to? First of all, just reflecting a moment on the developed world. I mean, I think we all agree that innovation is probably more important than ever. We may now have new ways of doing it, and we may have new tools to do it. I think that one of the biggest changes I've seen in the developed world is going to play out in the less developed world, or developing worlds, is that the tools that we have to do innovation with have now gotten to be awesome in power. So, both Bill and I, Eric, are now looking at a whole set of issues in material science. What we can now do in garages today could only be done with national labs with 1,000 people on those problems, 5 years ago, because of our ability now to build very complex models of natural phenomenon or material science and so on and so forth. So all of a sudden, what we thought was impossible a couple years ago is now become very possible. And so kind of the old Silicon Valley model of innovation may be back in play on very non-standard topics like new types of materials and so on and so forth. And that's, I think, both of us find that extremely exciting, because if you come out of the digital world, it's nice to see our digital tools now being used to go back to pushing atoms around in brand new ways and exciting things like that. I spend actually most of my time now in developing countries, but not the ones you just mentioned. Right. So, I'm particularly interested in what's going on in Asia in terms of China and India. And I think that we in the Western world have a lot to learn about innovation, not big bang innovation, but incremental innovation in terms of what's happening in China. I mentioned the Silicon Valley. Innovation usually happens in innovation ecologies, where you get rich cross-pollination of ideas. You get fast starts of companies that have quick deaths, and through that death, they become nutrients, but new types of thinking, and so on and so forth. So the kind of, I think it's really fair to say, look at Silicon Valley as an ecology, as an innovation ecology, if you wish. What would blew my mind is going through China and beginning to discover that, no, there's not one, two, or three innovation ecologies. There may be 700 innovation ecologies. And they're all operating in somewhat similar ways to us, but all relatively invisible because they're operating below the level of multinational companies. So the press, I might add, tends to look at China in terms of, I'm going to call it the two Chinas, either the Western part of China, which is a mess, or the multinational state-owned enterprise Chinas with their alleged spin-outs, which are hardly independent. But there's another kind of third China that has to do with these kind of entrepreneurial companies that have very limited access to private equity. And as a result, they actually have to kind of build networks of connections. So one guy focuses on this, another guy focuses on this, and this, and this. No one company is capable of assembling all the resources required. So they start building, through their extended family networks and other kind of networks, these vast networks. And these networks then cross-pollinate with other types of networks. So I think it's a different kind of innovation ecology happening there. Let me just take, for example, unlike Stanford, take Tsinghua University, which is kind of an equivalent. There are approximately 10,000 startups around that one university, and that's only one of the two ecologies around that university. And so I think that we're finding that a kind of innovation that's happening is not big bang innovation as we tend to think of it, although we may be surprised about that for other reasons, but it's the kind of the sense of being able to assemble on a moment's notice, through these loosely coupled networks, all the capabilities you want to do something really significant. And so kind of let me end with this, with saying we tend to think of the developing nations as India and China as places where a lot happens because of what you might call wage arbitrage. Okay? Our biggest discoveries is wage arbitrage is important, but there are two other kinds of arbitrage that are going on. There's actually skill arbitrage. And today, if you really wanted to build the casings of this phone here, or the magnesium casings, you can't do it very well in this country. The best place to go is to China. If you want to do certain kinds of systems on a chip, as opposed to complex chips, you go to another part of China. If you want to build cell phones, heaven help you if you try to compete with cell phones outside of China. And we can later on describe all the different ecologies at play in the cell phone industries, but they're all being orchestrated by things called ODMs, original design manufacturers, not original equipment manufacturers. And most in this company don't even know what an ODM is, except almost everything you own comes from ODMs. They don't put their names on it. But they become kind of the central manufacturing site that orchestrates hundreds of design firms around them to build, on a moment's notice, what somebody wants. And so there are kind of different mechanisms that are being created over there that I think we can have a lot to learn from.
Great, thank you. So we've heard that for the developed world, the abundance of new and phenomenal tools is a great advantage, and for the many developing countries, we have all these ecologies of innovation. What would you tell us?
Well, the first thing is that it's already been touched on a little bit, the computers are a tool that can simulate the things that you want to build. So the designs can be done in silicon, and this is applying not only to manufactured objects, but even to biology, which is becoming very digital. So the research and design lab is now more often than not becoming something that someone can have on their desk and they can even have in their house, because you know the supercomputers of 20 years ago that people used to design things now cost a few hundred dollars. But I think a larger effect probably is that the last 30 years we had one industry where we had extremely rapid advance. That was the electronics and communications field. And it came out of nowhere in a sense. I mean, there's no equivalent. You know, PCs exploded into a vacuum. People didn't have anything like that before. So it grew up with the culture of every 18 months things get two times better. And the whole culture and the economic structure and the people understand that. Using the computers now to redesign existing industries, you have a different kind of antecedent condition where the industries exist but they don't understand rapid change. Take, for example, the auto industry. There are new materials coming at the auto industry. There's now software in cars. You do a hybrid car, you got to have software. These things by Silicon Valley standards aren't very, very hard, but they go into an industry which is not used to any rapid change and even sustained change. It's an industry where innovation is cup holders, you know, or windshield wipers or something like this. You know, they've been stamping metal and buying glass and plastic for a very, very long time. And it's not just the auto industry that's going to get reinvented here by this. So the big change is that the kinds of innovations that have been we've become accustomed to in communications and computing are going to go into a lot of other fields, which where the industries really are on, the incumbents are not fleet of anything. Mm-hmm. So they are. And the playing field is very level. The economic advantage already tilts to the lower cost regions where there's lower cost manufacturing. People are aspiring, willing to work at lower wages. So it's a big threat to where these tools are powerful. I think they're more of a threat to the established economies than the newly industrializing or you know expanding industrializing economies have an advantage. Kind of a structural advantage. You see this, for example, in a different way in telecommunications, where the countries that didn't ever have a wired infrastructure simply put in wireless and skipped all the capital cost of putting in the wires. That's not quite a perfect analogy, but it shows how you can leapfrog past the previous mindset, say, of running a wire to everybody's house. Same thing could be true for wide broadband internet. That's within a couple of years. Intel announced yesterday what a $600 million investment in a company doing WiMAX, which is broadband wide area internet. So, you can skip that whole thing of fiber and all this other. You can build out a broadband infrastructure a lot more quickly. But this goes beyond communications and computing.
And would you say just a word more also about something you mentioned your opening presentation for the festival about the promise of material sciences? Both for all parts of the world, developed and developing.
Well, I think that we're very inefficient in our use of resources and our use of energy, and we've had cheap raw materials and we've had cheap energy, and this has allowed this. And it's no longer the case. I mean, the commodities have gone up dramatically in price, and the ecological impacts of these things are very great. But the amazing thing is that even at the low price of oil, these new technologies are so much better that they would be adopted, but were it the case that people are kind of hidebound. Amory, there's a book at the bookstore, Amory Lovins, and some other people wrote probably more than a decade ago called Factor 4, which says you can be four times, you can produce the same amount of well-being for a quarter of the energy and resource use, and to make more money while you're doing it, because if you use less material inputs and less waste, it's obviously you make more profit. It goes straight to the bottom line. And they wrote that book, Factor 4, and then other people realized, well, they were being modest. You could probably, in most cases, do Factor 10. You can get 10 times the gross well-being from the same amount of energy and resource inputs. And that's even before all these new revolutions in materials. So, when we look at what it would take to give everybody, say, a Western style of amenities and do a gross calculation, it looks like we need about 20 times as much to provide about 20 times as much as we're providing today. Mm-hmm. But with the combination of the kind of factor 10 thinking and all the things the new materials can do, I think we could do it for everybody with probably less of a footprint than we're doing today. And that's not going to be done by existing organizations that don't change. So that's the big threat, even more than, I think, low-cost labor is. You know, the U.S. cars, for example, don't meet the Chinese fuel economy standards. There's an example of how hidebound we are. We couldn't sell them in China. So that's how far behind we are in changing.
But you saw the electronic vehicle coming from China by miles here in front of the Aspen Meadows.
And I'd like to pursue in a minute some of the global implications of what you're saying. I want to ask a different kind of question now with this preface. In any line of work, there are things that insiders understand and outsiders can't really appreciate. I once worked in politics, and I think nobody who has not served on a presidential campaign can understand the role that fatigue plays in the mistakes people make and the way they come up with policy. It simply is the dominant fact of life that's never reported on. In your world, what is the thing that everybody, you, all of your colleagues understand and the rest of us don't understand, the main thing you wish outsiders could understand about your insider's world?
I mean, one level is the incredible excitement of change and the play of imagination and what can really happen with that. You know, if you think about it in a moment, kind of building what Bill was saying, most corporations have developed their practices, their management practices, in an age of continuity. Mm-hmm. But suddenly, we have a disjunct. The game has now changed in multiple ways. The technologies that are possible now, the global economy, et cetera, the whole internet. I mean, it's changed a lot of things. We may now be, in Drucker's sense, moving into, you know, a culture of discontinuity rather than a culture of continuity. Now, almost every single top-level manager in almost every corporation, starting with the automobile industries, got there by learning how to manage in continuity. So they basically have developed a set of practices based on a set of experiences, based on a set of assumptions, which are just no longer relevant. And the pain of being able to unlearn is much greater than the pain of being able to learn. So there's a lot of unlearning that has to happen. And, you know, Bill, I actually have done in the last 6 years a lot of work inside General Motors, and the pain to unlearn as the cars go software. 60% of the work now in even GM cars is software. You know, this is a mindset that requires a radical rethink.
Well, I mean, actually, the auto industry has deconstructed itself so that there's many tiers of suppliers. Mm-hmm. And so you can imagine, well, then it should be easy to put together a new car company because, in fact, you could. The thing is you couldn't sell your product because of the franchise laws. So, I mean, you know, we've got our economic system set up to guarantee who the winners are in a certain way that prevents – there's lots of levels at which necessary change will be prevented.
Let's just take that supplier network idea. Look at the difference between how Detroit – works with their suppliers versus the way Toyota does. I mean, Toyota actually views their vast supplier network as an innovation network. They expect suppliers to come to them with new ideas, challenging them, so on and so forth, and then compromises that get worked out between suppliers and so on. So basically that network is an innovation learning network. Detroit says, no, guys, you do it exactly this way. And so they are executors. They are not necessarily innovators. And so Toyota has kind of found the step toward open innovation, getting the best ideas of their supplier networks and then bringing them in and building long-term relationships with the suppliers. A lot of trust gets developed. A lot of skills get kind of moved back and forth. Even capital investments get made. And so it's kind of a step toward kind of an open innovation model.
And let me return with one sort of hard science question for you. What do you think you and your colleagues appreciate about technologies that are relatively easy and within reach and those that are impossibly difficult that the general public doesn't appreciate?
There's a lot of stuff that's within reach. It just needs to be deployed. I think I've been in particular looking at green technologies, and one of the things that's amazing is just how many areas there are for innovation. Say, take solar cells, for example. DARPA has a program to make 50% efficient solar cells. You say, well, that's nice. You know, they're 20% today, and if they were 50%, that obviously would be better. We generate more electricity. But there's secondary kind of amazing consequences to these things if you think them through. It turns out if you put 50% solar cells on the roofs of buildings and cities, it cools the city, you know, while generating electricity. You know, if you could desalinate, right now it costs, $1,000 an acre foot, I mean, to make fresh water from seawater. If you could make it for $250 an acre foot, you could desalinate seawater, grow crops, and export them and sell them. So, you know, and there's a factor of 4 or 5 possible in technological advance there. So these kinds of things have more than a simple... Mm-hmm. They have more than a simple linear change. At some point, a quantitative change becomes a qualitative change that changes the structure of things. And so, these hidebound industries that are holding on as their position gradually erodes. Look, what I saw in the paper today was that Kroger announced they're selling E85 ethanol at their grocery stores. Now you could say, well, the gasoline. Right. Dealers aren't doing it. Someone also had a thing where they said they had a hybrid electric, a gas electric vehicle, and they figured if you used it at your home, it was going to use so little gasoline you could buy it at the grocery store like you buy Fiji water. You just, you know, honey, get me a gallon of gas today because, you know,
almost
the car's
the
running
price,
low.
Yeah.
home in your shopping bag. Right, you wouldn't need, you know, if you really had a plug-in hybrid at home, you wouldn't need a gas station. So, you know, it's sort of the belief that this is all, there's going to be some sort of gradual change. You know, these things which are quite familiar. My son asked me, when's the last internal combustion engine going to be manufactured? Mm-hmm. You know, and I said, that's a reasonable question. Let's try to figure it out. You know, how about 2025? You know, or I don't know. I mean, you know, when are they going to shut down the last gas station?
Yeah.
You know, because clearly there is enough. I don't know whether that it's possible that that won't happen. They could morph and be something else. But the kind of things that seem like fixtures are. So we see business plans all the time. Generally, if they want to make a huge infrastructural change like that, it's not a good short-term venture investment. But
you need a lot of patient money there. But,
yeah.
But you know, it's going back even to the kind of culture you grew up with at Berkeley, Bill, as interesting as kind of a new class of hackers coming, and then, I mean, they're hacking the Prius, doing exactly what you said. You know, and that happens enough, and pretty soon you can't ignore it, just like it happened in the computer game. But you know, it's also interesting to me to see how it's actually the graduate students at the universities that are actually driving the faculty to start to consider some of these new types of opportunities. And if you look at Berkeley right now, under Tom Khalil's program there, the undergraduates and graduates are coming together with amazing proposals, you know, for example, on water purification, et cetera, that then, you know, the faculty are almost embarrassed to kind of have to join in because the problems are so interesting. And that's what the students really want to work on. You know, they require a different way of thinking about some of these problems.
You know, one other thing that's been amazing is that we don't have a perfect ability to model the physical world. So if we have a drug, we can't in a computer tell what it's going to do in a patient. And there's, you know, systems biology where people want to make a computer model of how the, you know, cells work or... And maybe 50 years from now we'll be able to predict this, but today we have no chance. But what we are seeing is that with a combination of kind of robotic technology and computers, you can do very, very organized searches. You know, one example of this would be mapping the human genome. What they do, they took the genome and they chopped it into lots of little pieces with robots, essentially, and then they had computers put the pieces back together. So it was a very disciplined and organized way of investigating the physical world. You can also take and essentially automate what Thomas Edison's lab did when he was looking for a light, filament. Yeah. He looked at famously thousands of things. Yeah. Well, you can do the same thing now. You can, you know, you need some material with a certain property, and it's a complex alloy of several different things. You can build essentially a test fixture which just tries a billion possibilities. And largely, the scientific discovery in the past was kind of hit and miss. And if you look really hard, you can, in almost every case, find something that's substantially enough better to make a commercial difference from what a company that did it the old way in the last century has as their cash cow, cash cow product. So people that don't adopt this new style of discovery and invention will have problems. And it's also harder to protect because often you go and look and you find five ways of doing things. So what's the marginal value of any one of them? But if you didn't adopt any right. of them, you're pretty much.
What's accelerating this even more now is a lot of the examples that we have to do combinatorial design on, we can now do almost ab initio design. We can design from first principles of quantum mechanics, and not biological systems as well as more structural systems, nanoparticles of certain kinds. And so the whole search has gone away in some sense. Well, at least now is a very, very intelligent type of search. But I want to kind of raise an issue that, it has hit me that, there's kind of an interesting path. I mean, science progresses to a point, enough scientific breakthroughs happen that it enables us to build new technology. And the technology runs along for a while, gets better and better and better. And suddenly, we wake up one day and we find these wonderful technological tools actually transform the way we do science,
right.
which is one of the examples that Bill just gave. And so we're kind of entering an interesting period now where the tools that we have to do fundamental science, such as bioscience, also understanding much more about the brain than we ever could before, the instruments we have for making sense out of that are amazing. But it's not clear that the country has the appetite for then saying, here is a window of opportunity. This may be the time in the next 10 years where we can make phenomenal advances in science.
Right.
And so it's a kind of an interesting kind of interplay between science to technology that changes the way we do science that then changes the technology. And, one of the things I think that scares both of us here is, the way to do science to a large extent is changing. And we have the tools that I could only dream about 5 years ago to use. And we have surprising little funding for that kind of...
Right. I know Ed Wilson is here, I think, in the second... I haven't seen him around, but I think he's here for the second half of the conference. And he wrote a book a number of years ago called Consilience.
Sure.
And he talked about how, ideas from...
Excerpted in the Atlantic, of course.
Yes, but probably where I read it first.
It was a cover story, I believe.
Yeah. Anyways, the idea is that there's ideas from different disciplines come together. And I have a project right now where I'm working with some physicists, and they're from different areas of physics. And I have to tell you, they've got a new idea of how to solve a really hard problem. So we put them in our diligence process, which is pretty hard. We get some of the best people we know to pound on them. But what's amazing is, if they hit a wall, because there are problems, I think their overall idea will work, but every piece of it has some problems, is they simply do a complete end run. They go to a completely different physical phenomenon, change the whole thing, and they come back again. And so what you're seeing is, in order to participate in a more and more consilient world where, physics and chemistry and biology and software are all coming together, the breadth of a scientific education you have to have to compete at the highest level, or the breadth of the team that you have to have, is quite large. And just like the Aspen Institute had, the Chicago Great Books and this idea of the broadly educated person, I think in science also we're not only falling behind in science, but falling behind from a standard which I don't think is adequate. Mm. The standard has to be that, you can't just be educated as a computer engineer, because if you're going to, more than likely, you're going to be using it as an application for something, and you have to be educated about that as well, and other things will come in. So you can't be a biologist without knowing something about databases these days, because the way in which you organize this digital information that you collect in your biology affects whether you can get any benefit out of it.
There's almost no single major breakthrough I can think of in the last 5 years that was done within one silo, within one discipline. And, biology is one of the best examples. It's just exploding in terms of visualization, informatics, and now mechanics as well as classical biological and chemistry.
Someone brought us an innovation which involved the guy had a deep understanding of the web press and an obscure physical phenomenon that most of the published papers are in the 1800s. And the combination of those two things led to this demonstration that you could hardly believe. So, it's this cross-disciplinary stuff that brings, that's where the real exciting innovations are.
In a curious sort of way, I used to think that was the secret juice of Park. Mm-hmm. A, it was small, but B, we had about eight different
disciplines.
The Palo Alto Research Center that, yeah. You know, ranging from anthropology on one hand all the way to theoretical physics in between. And, you know, getting it small enough that there was tremendous cross-pollination of points of view on a particular problem. And how do you get kind of different, you know, each discipline has its own way of learning, its own way of thinking. And part of the whole cross-disciplinary challenge is how do you get people willing to engage in a little bit of, you might call it listening with humility, to listen to somebody else's worldview. But that's much easier when there's a driving problem and a passion to solve that problem, which the examples that Bill's been using.
I have a list of 20 more questions here. I expect by now you probably have 100. Indulge me only in one, and then I'll turn it over to the rest of you. If I were here in newspaper reporter mode, which I've been at certain times in my life, and I had to report on the discussion so far, I'd say on the one hand, this is tremendously exciting. You know, the consilience phenomenon, all the new things that are possible in running scientific experiments, in applying to the technology, the virtuous cycle of science breeding technology, breeding science, all those sorts of things. And so I would come away thinking, gee, it's going to be different kinds of engines, different kinds of power and all the rest. But I would think that in various ways, you've all suggested there's going to be a social and economic problem for the United States. There's going to be the wage arbitrage issue, the design arbitrage issue, the culture of old companies that can't adapt, the declining scientific education from a low standard, the funding for things that you are excited about. Would that be a fair interpretation of the discussion so far?
When I was young, I always, people said, the early bird gets the worm, and do you want a worm? I mean, I don't know if I want to get up early to get a worm. I'd like the other things. So the question is, we were early adopters of a certain group of technologies, a certain way of manufacturing, and I'm not sure that that's, and also of a certain mindset about what cars should be like and all these sorts of things that are now really not an advantage for us. So I think the U.S. is going to face a substantial challenge.
So I think we have some structural challenges ahead of us that way, but let me throw out a slightly different a metaphor. I mean, you know, Tom Friedman has written a brilliant book on the world is flat, okay, and we all kind of know what that means. I'd like to put on top of that another phrase that was borrowed from Richard Florida, say, no, maybe the world is really spiky. Mm-hmm. And the issue in thinking about spikiness is you start looking around the world and you say, you know, there's a tremendous competence, very narrowly defined over here, over here, over here, over here. And so the new forms of industrialization may be to use the fact that the world is flat to be able to interconnect. Mm-hmm. So first you got to find, then interconnect, and then nurture. So we may be going back, ironically, to Adam Smith. Adam Smith said, you know, greatest advances were made through specialization. Mm-hmm. Today, there may be a new form you might call dynamic specialization that helps us find, linked, and then create productive friction that gets everybody learning faster and better. And that is so fundamentally against the usual organizational architectures we think of in this country. So I think that, you know, in a curious sort of way, our challenge is to think differently about some of these, not only infrastructural issues, but even organizational mm-hmm. issues, organizational forms.
And the spikiness might bring us back even earlier than Adam Smith, say to the medieval times where you had walled cities that were centers of knowledge and expertise and sort of wastelands around them. Would that be an implication too? You have Berkeley, which is doing great, and you have the Silicon Valley, and you have other parts that are not.
But that's why the flatness is important.
Yeah.
You see, because now you can go through these walled cities and connect them together in various ways if you know how to orchestrate. So maybe the real talent of tomorrow is to know how to find and orchestrate, and the value you bring is how you make a positive sum game out of the orchestration.
It's hard to see a good outcome for the United States if we don't make anything. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I think you have to stand back and say, what exactly are we going to make? You know, and I go back to Warren Buffett's thing in the Fortune magazine he wrote about the two islands, mm-hmm. you know, one of which only sends their money to the other one. The other people end up owning the island that spends everything. So it seems to me you have to send something over. You have to send something out, and it has to be something that's made here. And I couldn't tell you what it's going to be. I mean, because we don't seem to be focusing on manufacturing matters, you know. So that's very disturbing.
With that, I pass the baton to the audience, and if you would, please identify yourselves with the question.
My name is John Anda. My question is about catalysts. I think all this is really interesting. I want to ask the panel about a couple of catalysts. You know, one catalyst for change, particularly as you said, Bill, in using resources and energy, is price. For price to be a catalyst, though, essentially you need low price volatility. And then a good example would be that, you know, oil is $70 now, but we remember the 80s and oil plummeted and all the ideas we had went away. So you know, essentially, without that low volatility around high prices, price as a catalyst could fail us. The second catalyst, I guess, would be that pure supply. Supply creates its own demand. And that, I think, a lot of the information revolution was like that, where you didn't need the experience curve or economies of scale. The technology was so good and improved, you know, doubling every 18 months, that the supply created its own demand. I think in some of these areas about materials and energy, I think it's pretty tricky to expect that. I'd love to hear particularly Bill's comments about that. The third catalyst is the green catalyst, which I'm really leery of being an environmentalist myself, but to say, you know, is green a catalyst for both producers and consumers? In the end, producers are there to make money and consumers are there to buy things cheaply. I own a hybrid and I paid more for it. I'm an environmentalist, but that's not going to affect many people in China, blah, blah, blah. So the green catalyst, I'm not sure, worries me. Obviously, that leads to policy motivators, but I'd just be curious about what some of the catalysts you think are going to be for these great technologies to really come about.
So, Bill, would you like to start with that?
Can I answer the first one? Very briefly, the idea of price floors for ethanol would go to your first point, because what happened was there was a high oil price before people put money in ethanol, and then the market crashed. So the way people have been thinking about this is to put a minimum price on gasoline, or is find some politically acceptable way to provide the protection for the people to make investments in ethanol, like to say if the price of gas goes below $1.99, then you'll subsidize ethanol, because people don't want to tax gasoline. The idea of a minimum price for gasoline upsets people.
We should never subsidize products.
But, well, but the point is to provide a guarantee so people can make an investment, because so that the Saudis don't crash the people don't crash the gasoline market just to put the ethanol guys out of business. Let's see,
so that we had a price stability, a sheer supply, and the green catalyst as other possible factors.
Yeah, I think what I said before kind of characterizes, I think green technologies can win because they're more economical. And one example of that would be Walmart, which is going green internally to save money, as well as for the PR value probably. But they can save a huge amount on their fleet by adopting more fuel-efficient vehicles. They can save a huge amount of energy and dollars by making their buildings more energy efficient, and it's good PR for the company too. So I think they're very, very serious about that. So I think corporations can save huge amounts of money.
The only thing I would add to that, and I'm not sure you would call it a catalyst, but is the whole issue of how patient is capital. Because basically, you know, the places that used to have patient capital are large-scale corporations. Well, they've lost the ability to think out of the box. Wall Street doesn't have very much patience. VCs have a certain amount of patience. And the real question, can we get enough done within that window that stuff starts to pay off? And so there's kind of, you know, and I mean, the gut intuition is we're now getting in that window that the amount of patience that VCs, especially first-tier VCs, have may be the right to be able to make this thing happen.
And the middle point was, I think, about supply and demand. I mean, George Gilder always said, you know, you have to identify for each year what the abundance, what the things that are abundant and the things that are scarce. And, you know, you want to use them in such a relative proportion. So, for example, right now communications is abundant, and hence that's why jobs have become so mobile. You know, the jobs that can be moved to lower wage environments do so. Certain kinds of transportation is probably getting more expensive, so that puts a geographic disadvantage at remote location of certain industries. You know, obviously you're not going to have gravel. You're not going to have all the gravel pits moved to China, to take, you know, extreme example of it. So, but people, I don't think, are they forward forecasting the real cost of transportation and the real cost of bits, which is scarce, which is abundant?
I have a related and yet off topic. I'll save it for later. Yes, please.
I'm Howard Gardner. I think a lot about educational issues, and I'm willing to accept that multidisciplinary thinking is going to be very, very important in the future, and you guys are great examples of that. You're talented, you're privileged. In John's case, he'd like to be able to construct an environment over 20 or 30 years, which is great. Where I'm completely hung up is if you want to encourage people to do multidisciplinary thinking, interdisciplinary thinking, say before graduate school or before going to work at some park or place like that, is there a better way of doing it? Do you just throw problems at people? Do you try to teach them first one discipline and then another? To what extent is this just a kind of a random or chaotic system, or are there really structured ways in which you fashion education systems such that you encourage high-level multidisciplinary understanding and production?
How do we create the people we need?
Yeah, let me take just two shots at that. I mean, it's very interesting. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, that around 1960, many of the youth of the 60s were completely galvanized by going into space. And so our imaginations were fired up. That brought people from all kinds of different disciplines together to kind of think about what that would mean, and let's take science education much more seriously and other kinds of education, dot, dot, dot. You know, today, besides the energy game, and one of the most interesting things I've seen now going on is, you might call it bio-inspired design. What can we learn from the way that the natural, the animal kingdom actually works? Not mimicking it, but as a source of design ideas for building amazing devices. Now, I tell you that if you go into that very seriously, you got to know biology, mechanics, mathematics, computation. I mean, and around that problem, just like in the biology problem that Bill was talking, the genome problem, amazing skills have to come together. But you can't keep kids away once they kind of stumble into this area. So in some sense, maybe the real question is, and by the way, I'm talking about undergraduates, not graduate students and so on and so forth. So I think part of the question is, how do we start to inspire and find the environments and let kids find the excitement of something like that? And I think we don't think much about that.
And I wish there were just more of these kind of big books that we could read that would really help us to learn. I recently have been doing a lot of ventures that involve chemistry, so. I'm reading Linus Pauling's book on chemistry. But you go to Barnes and Nobles and you find the little tiny science book section, and you find the little tinier section on chemistry. And what do you, how many books are there that you could actually pick up and learn it? Chemistry for Dummies? That won't get you very far, Or some of Jared Diamond's writing, or Ed Wilson's writing, that really give you a sense for the field, so that you have some idea of the way people think and do things in these fields. So you get started, and then just have a project where it matters. I mean, I took chemistry years ago, but it was just a class I was taking. It didn't matter to anything I was doing. So I think we have to make it exciting by giving hands-on problems that involve multiple disciplines.
Yes?
Bill, I enjoyed your comments about consilience. I actually read that book several years ago and founded a company called Consilien, just so I could meet Ed Wilson. We're great. But I wonder if we have an environment that really supports that sort of multidisciplinary, cross-disciplinary sort of innovation. I went to your panel this morning, and the Google guy was talking about, we basically don't do anything that can't be productized in less than 6 months by a handful of guys. And I'm not sure you get a cross-disciplinary team or even just a thought process to completion and productize in 6 months. And also, if you talk to, VCs are picking up on that threat these days. And they want, Web 2.0 to them means, you can mash together in no time, and target some market and sort of start generating revenues with minimal investment. And I don't see a history of really profound innovations happening in that type of environment.
I think it's where we are in the cycle with the internet. I mean, in the early days, what we had to do is we had to develop protocols, we had to get things to scale. We had to do some of the lower levels and really get them to work. And now it's more of a fashion show. I mean, they're really rolling out. Google's rolling out the fall collection. Here's some things to see if people, if they're addictive, if they'll be viral, if people will end up spending their time looking at this, so they'll see more ads. It has nothing. It's at that level, which is not the level at which the economy transforming innovations are going to occur.
The counterexample I would have, and there are very, very few in this country, is take a company like Corning that's 125 years old, it reinvented itself six times, and it takes seriously, starting at the board all the way down, that innovation is its business. And they have decided on five core competencies in the research labs that then constantly kind of interact. So, for example, their latest product is a new kind of biochip. Okay, well, the biochip has in the slide, you know, a million waveguides, you know, bringing all the ideas from fiber optics into kind of the biology world, being able to detect assays and things that connect to it. And it's just, you know, that kind of environment, but that's patient capital. It's patient capital because basically it's a family-owned company. It's a public company, but there's a certain sense, there's a certain ethics in that company that says we're here for the long haul.
So we have a queue here now. First you, and then you, and then you on the side of the room, then we'll go to the other side. Yes, go ahead.
So on the subject of consilience, it seems that the world is kind of going a little lightweight. You've got lightweight software now that's, you know, over and above the thick client software. And you've got Google with a product development cycle of 6 months. What's sort of education doing to keep pace with this change? And yesterday I brought up the subject that I have an MBA and I brought it up with Joel Klein and I said that I feel uneducated and he laughed at me and I thought you're not listening to me because there are things that I want to do and there aren't any options other than going back to a 4-year college and getting an undergrad in a different subject or a 2-year master's degree in something else. But there's a lot that I want to learn and contribute in this world of consilience. And it feels that the educational options aren't available to me, some kind of modular, a different curriculum, basically, you know, that keeps that's in step with the changing world.
And I'm going to assume this room is small enough that everyone can hear the questions that are being asked. If that's so, yes. Do you have how can education be modular?
Well, I face this every day. You know, this company's going to come present to me at 10 o'clock, and I'm reading Wikipedia at 9 to try to figure out what. Or just looking up the words in the slides, you know, because almost every single one of them is some phenomenon. If I have heard of it, I only remember vaguely. You know, I know whether it's a chemistry or a physics or an electronics concept. You know, it's the Jaworski effect, you know, okay, what's that, you know? That turns out to be the fundamental thing. And, you know, all of us have to constantly, I think, re-educate ourselves in our jobs. And I wish there was more stuff online that I could go to that would be more tutorial, you know, like paced learning where you could go through so you felt like you really knew it as opposed to always feeling like you have holes.
I mean, it's also interesting to ask, think of today's universities. I mean, today's universities that are preparing people for a single career aren't doing much justice to what students really need. Students in the 21st century have to be prepared to have multiple careers, and what are the kind of skills that you want to be able to pick up new types of information, you know, which has often, by the way, as much to do with social intelligence in terms of how do you learn from others as it does some IQ. And in fact, in today's 21st century, I think of IQ, EQ being social, and CQ being communication intelligence, because we learn most of what we want to learn, first maybe by going to Wikipedia, then using our networks to be able to kind of talk to theoretical physicists about what does this term really mean. And one other thing that's happening, kind of one step behind Wikipedia, is there's a huge movement in this country building open education resources. For example, MIT's open courseware, and that's just scratching the surface. If you go actually to connections at Rice, you actually get access to very interesting tools to be able to experiment with things. And so I actually, you know, not only just go to Wikipedia, but then I would try to dive into like the open learning initiatives at CMU that actually let you kind of take a course and actually do the experiments, work out the math, use their tools to solve the equations, and so on. So I think we're finding that there are kind of for the 21st century, this might be one of the places that this country could be leading in terms of leading the movement toward providing this access for us after we leave school to be constantly able to kind of refresh.
Yes, you're up.
One of my questions was, how do people like us, my age, in the late 50s, early 60s, learn about all this stuff? I mean, you try and you get your child, you hope your child's educated so they can teach you how to do these. You can't even use the information, and then you just get lost and you learn it. But the other thing I wanted to say, I don't think you wait till you go to college to teach these kids.
Right.
You start in grammar school and you put these subjects together. You can use the computer to teach. I worked with Mortimer Adler, with my daughter worked with him.
Right.
And I got to tell you something. And so they don't get embarrassed if they make mistakes when they're very young. But they can do it with the computer, and then they have the teacher. And you do this all the way through school.
You know, I think we'd all tremendously agree with you. In fact, we were listening to a wonderful story a couple of days ago with a four-year-old and kind of what that four-year-old is capable of doing and how the parents are starting to learn by this four-year-old in terms of the freedom to be able to kind of find his way around. Not that he, you know, it's so interesting that, you know, half of us in this room wear glasses. We don't think of glasses as technology because it's been with us all the time. You know, the four-year-olds, even 10-year-olds, they don't think of the internet as technology. It's been with them all the time. It's the most natural extension of self you can imagine. And I think that there's a, you know, I kind of been very interested in this notion of what I call reverse mentorship. And that is, you know, how do I mentor myself to a, in my case, a 20-year-old or 26-year-old game designer to kind of learn how to think in their community terms, kind of entering their community of practice. You know, you do that through apprenticeship. And reverse apprenticeship could be a very interesting construct. You know, one last kind of spill on that is, you know, there's a lot, as you know, there's a lot of work in people playing games, et cetera. And one of my kind of specialties is World of Warcraft and the guilds that happen there. Parents keep asking me, you know, what's going on here? And I can't communicate with my son or daughter anymore. You know, whether or not you want to say it's a waste of time, Bill, or not, you know, I say, hey, parents, why don't you join the guild? And they say, well, but I don't know how. Well, I thought you had an expert. Well, can you learn from your son or daughter? And through that kind of dialogue, a new kind of thing starts to happen. We're actually looking at certain guilds that have three different generations, grandparents, parents, and kids, all in the same guild as a kind of... but, I mean, well, what happens is a kind of communication that you might not expect to see.
So the cue for the moment is this gentleman here, gentleman in the back, in fairness to this side, then two people over here, an observation is fascinating that a discussion that began on sort of the technology and world economy subject has concentrated entirely on sort of the intellectual and cultural attributes of learning. Yes, go ahead.
I was going to bring it back to the technology and global economy question. I had a philosophical question about the developing world. By way of background, I'm the Assistant Director General for WHO and in charge of technology and pharmaceuticals. And I've spoken a lot with the member states and the ministers of health. When I push forth the idea of technology, the question that comes back is, we can't afford this in the developing world. We have bigger problems to deal with, and technology costs a lot. How do we get over that inertia? Is this a government-run problem, you know, within the governments, or is this something that the individuals in the countries should do? And also the question which we were talking about a little bit before, how did certain countries like India and China already move forward on some of these issues?
At Kleiner Perkins, we created a special fund to work on pandemic preparedness, and especially H5N1. And when you start looking at the numbers, say, to improve the surveillance network so you could try to contain an outbreak, and you realize the scale of the problem and the number of workers you need in rural areas and the really minimal amount of equipment that is available to people, and you're quite humbled by thinking you're going to roll in with this solution to this one particular problem, which we're concerned about because can it affect us, and yet they have this, such a dearth of infrastructure, just putting together tens of thousands of health clinics to deal with endemic problems in these regions. So, you know, one of the things we've been trying to do is to be aware of the logistical issues with, say, drugs. Like, for example, we have Tamiflu, which is an antiviral. Doesn't work particularly well against H5N1. And it also is a regime you have to take for many days. And it really needs refrigeration. If you read its temperature limits, it really won't hold up in a tropical environment. So, you know, if you're going to come up with an antiviral that's going to work in the world, what we've been looking at is we're working with a company, and it's going to be intramuscular single dose. And so you can imagine going into a village and vaccinating everybody in a few hours, just line everybody up and run them through, and you're done, and you don't have to follow through with things that are logistically unrealistic in this environment. If you want to do an information gathering, you've got to do something like mini-M terminals or some cell, you know, two-way SMS kind of cell phone that a person can carry, and maybe with a little solar panel so they can recharge it in an environment where they don't. And let them do social entrepreneuring, you know, microfinance entrepreneuring on top of their phone to make it worth it to them. Give them the phone, let them do other things with it or something. You got to be realistic about, I think, what tools people, putting a computer in a some sort of internet connection in some of these places just doesn't make logistical. It's not affordable. So it's sobering to look at the realities of you know, going all the way to the places where such a problem exists.
You know, I also think we have to be a little bit careful. I mean, there's unique problems in the deep rural parts you're talking about. And I'm a little bit surprised by the way you framed that question, if I heard it right, because in many ways, you were finding certainly medical advances in India that surpass what we do in this country. And so, again, it's spiky. Okay, I can show you places that you would want to go for back surgery that would match anything you will find in this country. And we have some of the best back surgeons in the world. Okay? Eyes is obvious. We've already had a talk on that, blah, blah, blah. You know, I do a little bit of stuff with the Beijing Genomics Institute. Okay, they're the ones that sequenced SARS. They're the ones that are sequencing the rice. And it's very interesting. If you walk into that warehouse, you know, you see an operation which is simply awesome. But the interesting thing is they're not doing it for profit. They're actually open sourcing everything that they do because they don't want American companies to come in and patent, you know, certain genomic sequences. And so you find a lot of different things happening there. And, you know, I think you're going to find more and more American drug companies going there to do drug testing because you go into certain parts of India, you have enough distribution of people that you find out you can do a drug test much faster there than you can do here. Yeah.
So, again, our order now is this gentleman here, then over here, then two on this side. And to remind people of the self-identification goal, I'll identify Kenneth Adelman as the person with the next question.
Thank you. This may be a mundane question for a very erudite panel and a very good panel here. But is there any creativity, any innovation out there like the Internet which will change everything?
The next big thing.
Well, I would say that there's many next big things. You know, if we look at the history of our firm, which started in 72, I mean, in the beginning, it was the semiconductors was the big beginning thing, and with some very early stirrings of the life sciences. Then it was personal computing era. Then it was, you know, the network, the internet, and then the consumer internet, networking, and then the consumer internet. But now what we see is green technologies. We see new opportunities in digital technology really applied to medicine. Really, the genomics revolution really blossoming, and plus all the traditional categories like software and hardware. So you're seeing across a range of disciplines, and so I don't think it's a single theme. I don't think this is a single theme environment. We're very challenged simply because of the breadth of the innovations that we're seeing. They come in clumps, and we often get very unbalanced, where we get nine things that are all the same in 1 week, that only two of the ten principal of us who are looking at these things can understand. We get individually buried. So that's kind of the nature today of innovation, is it's very broad.
You know, the two things I'd build on that is, I mean, two of our biggest problems. Let's take healthcare. I mean, I think that our ability to have radical innovation in how we think about healthcare is going to happen. And that's part of what Bill's getting at in terms of drug design, you know, personalized drug design, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's another question in the back of my mind that, you know, Howard might scream at, but, you know, we don't ask ourselves the question, might there be a way to speed up learning by a factor of 100? You know, have we just settled for the pace of learning is what it is today, and may there be kind of fundamentally new ways of this? And the reason why I might raise this question is, if you look at being an Aspen, if you look at our ability to teach somebody how to ski, we've been able to increase the speed of learning how to ski pretty competently by about a factor of 100 through multiple uses of technology, design of environments, all kinds of things. I won't bore you with all the things that go into that. But it's about a factor of 100 in the last 20 years. Now, there's a lot of money to that because you get more people coming here and they have better time, dot, dot, dot. I kind of wonder why we can't do the same.
Well, we actually heard, but haven't had a chance to follow through. There's some neurobiologist on the East Coast who thought in her work that she'd uncovered some of the principles that would reactivate some of the learning circuits that are available. You have your early in life that don't seem to be as active later.
Like language learning, for example?
Yeah.
Right, right.
Some
absolutely
of those same circuits might be. So there might be a biochemical basis for
it could
turning,
be a partial,
turning learning
right
on.
Yeah. But it may also be that, you know, a lot of us have, thank you, Howard, different kinds of intelligence. But, you know, with the whole role of visual, the ability now to understand everything in much more deep kind of interactive visual ways may enable us to kind of get gut feelings for things that are just very hard to have gotten in the past. So, I mean, you know, so both the scientific and some of the kind of presentation forms to engage oneself in, you know, may actually enable putting all this together to kind of change the game that way.
And we're, we have a little more than 15 minutes here. I'm going to encourage everyone to move sort of into lightning round mode, both of the questions and the answers. Yes.
Bill Lozier, and I, Bill, I believe you have written about the dangers of technological advancement. And I wonder if the two of you could comment on what the downside has been to technology up till now and what it might be in the future.
Why don't I let you go first?
You know, whenever you make a radical change in technology, it takes us often, you know, a decade to discover what may be some of the downsides of it. And it's been very interesting to take our favorite topic, Bill's mind, and, you know, nanotechnology. How now, for example, that the government sponsoring several of the major nano centers in the country have now started a major effort to look at the ethics of nanotechnology. How do you actually get ahead of this curve? How do you start thinking through some of the ethical considerations that really have to be? How do you bring the right set of people together to open up the discourse model? And I was very interested to see that the government decided to actually to fund such an effort. You know, I think in part as a response to some of the things that Bill had done, you know, a few years ago. But that whole sense of as these technologies keep pulling further and further away from our common sense understanding, how do we get more and more people kind of engaged in understanding? We got to make sure that there's a discourse being where all of us are actually being brought into this. And so, you know, maybe the, one of the biggest challenges of scientific literacy is to have a literate enough, to find how to have a literate enough public to actually have a meaningful discussion about these types of topics.
And so what do you think have been the downsides? So
well, I think the clearly the biggest downside so far has probably been the construction of nuclear weapons, which are, you know, still a threat to us all, which makes terrorism look like small stuff, as we're all obsessing about. And the greater danger with technology is something on the scale of the threat from a nuclear device. It gets into the hands of, becomes software, becomes easily accessible to many, many people. You know, my view is that things like the weapons were created by at enormous expense over a long period of time by large groups. I mean, look at Hanford and how long it took them to refine and all the work. If the Iranians are doing it, how much work it is to do that. And, you know, I think we rightly recognize that that's not the result of that is not something we want everyone to have access to. So to the extent that technology creates the possibility of someone having something that potent without that kind of deeply difficult material to construct economic barrier, then there's a big risk. The biggest danger is probably an abuse of biotechnology because that's what we're built of. And, you know, people bioengineering pathogens for whatever purposes are doing something by accident. And that's something I think people are aware of. Well, there was a front page story in The Guardian how they ordered all the bits of smallpox and got them sent to them in the mail, the gene little pieces. So clearly you can buy and assemble these pieces, and it's something we need to get a better control over.
You know, but it's interesting if you look at nuclear. If we had taken more seriously these issues back in the early days, we would have built different kinds of reactors. Now, none of this is foolproof. I mean, it's, you know, totally safe. But, you know, this country has been very hesitant to engage in, for example, pebble bed reactors. Who's now doing that? South Africa and China. Well, pebble bed reactors not only are very, very safe, but they're a little bit hard to misuse.
So we have, I think, two people have been waiting on this side, the gentleman over here. Yes. You're then, yes, first you and then you.
I want to comment on last year's talk, Bill. I heard you speak, and I wondered if you could comment on the U.S.'s competitive advantage. Last year you discussed in terms of China and India, and you were somewhat nervous about whether the United States would be able to maintain a competitive advantage. And you said that you were hopeful that our ability to be entrepreneurial and to be innovative would become our competitive advantage. And today I heard you stop at saying you were nervous about us not having a manufacturing competitive advantage, and you didn't continue on. Are you still hopeful that that will be our competitive advantage, or something happened in the last year?
We have a new nominee for the downside of technology over here. I think
it's not you.
I think what we like to say is that we have a Chinese sense of urgency in our firm, which I think reflects an increasing awareness of how hard people are studying, working, entrepreneuring in India and China. And I don't, you know, outside of certain places in the United States, I don't see that sense of urgency right now. I think we're asleep a little bit as to the competitive threat. Someone at one of the opening panels said that, I don't remember who thought there was a 40% downside risk on the, you know, standard of living in the United States. I mean, that's the scale of it. It's not hard to see why. If an hour of work here is worth the same as an hour of work worth there, just take the wages, extrapolate a little bit of growth, and convert the currencies, and you'll see what they're talking about. And so, you know, we have to move our industries forward. We have to be making stuff that other people want to buy. That's good high-margin quality stuff to keep good jobs here. And I think it's mostly the manufacturing industries that I'm most concerned about. When John was talking about Dow and, you know, Monsanto and 3M, the chemical companies, the pharmaceutical companies, they have good, solid, you know, enviable research. It's the more of our manufacturing and industrial scale things, more like the auto companies and companies of that ilk that are threatened. But that's where the vast majority of the jobs are. So.
And I think it's kind of a complacency. Even the complacency in Silicon Valley, that we can always innovate out of problems when the time actually comes, with very little appreciation for not just the dimension of the skills in China, but the speed at which those skills are developing, and therefore, and driven by the passion for people that have now been unleashed to be able to invent their own future, both in India and China, unleashed for different reasons, of course. But, you know, that you can't be, I mean, you're holding awe. You walk down the street in any of these places, you know, in Bangalore and Shanghai, you know, the passion of these kids to want to kind of do things. It's I find it kind of scary. I mean, awesome in a good sense, but, you know.
See, I think the woman in the back was the one who was waiting for a while, then over here, then back to the side. Yes.
I would like to ask you, what do you think of internet neutrality and the defeat of it in Washington? How will that affect internet-based technologies and enterprises in the United States?
Well, it's good that everybody can get to every... It's an internet that you can get to everything is a good thing.
And does everyone here understand the issue, or would you give
the
issue, a 30-second
gloss? The issue is that the people who own the networks would like to extract more revenue from them by giving preferential carriage to people who pay them money. I think they have a fair argument. If they build a network, then they, you know, and but it's to the user's benefit and everybody's benefit for the country if these things are accessible to everyone. So it's a political fight that will likely go on, but it'll disadvantage us if it inhibits innovation in the United States. We're already behind in internet innovation, I think, behind places like Korea, for example, with advanced services.
So. I mean, from my point of view, it's a step down a very slippery slope. I mean, this first one looks a little bit innocuous. It could have been much worse. But once you step walking down that slope, it can get worse and worse and worse. And I don't think this country understands just how far behind we are in broadband. I mean, I like to think of the fact that I drink, you know, bits through a straw. They call it broadband in this country is a straw. The reason I first thought of going to Korea is they're approximately 10 years ahead of us. And if you want to understand kind of how the social practices that start to emerge in a real broadband culture, you have to go outside of this country to see it.
I'm going to have the executive fiat of asking now to have a number of questions in a row, which we'll answer in a block two. Yes, you are next.
Well, my question is half a question, half a comment. It seems to me, although being totally ignorant in the world of technology, that probably the next big thing that will change everything is the phenomenon of cloning.
Cloning.
Yeah. And I was wondering if we will see that as a big advancement because it will be our ticket to eternal life, or that we'll see it as a threat.
So we have cloning, positive threat or menace or benefit. Yes, sir.
Well, I'll speak about genomes. Genomes have now been identified for all sorts of human skills.
Right.
Do you visualize the VC firm doing a swab of the key executives of the potential company that you're going to invest in somewhere in the 50-year future?
So 50 years of engineering managers and CEOs. Yes, yes.
Can we import the passion by changing our immigration laws, the passion that you're talking about, that you're seeing in China and India? And is that a complacency that's built into our system? Or
right.
Values or whatever, and would that be changed by changing immigration laws?
Yes, over here.
With the military being filled by the lower classes, can you speak about the weapons of mass destruction being in the have-nots versus the haves in this country?
Yes, here.
Can we shut down, can we bring, cultivate the passion by shutting down some of the media exchanges in America?
No, but you don't mean like The Atlantic or anything, right?
No, television and all yeah. The game playing and the eagerness great. Of these minds wanting to.
Great. Yes, Matt.
Is the flow of venture capital moving to India and China now, or is it still in this country?
We have an embarrassment of riches here. Yes.
Do we have a chance if technology is easily stolen, patents easily infringed upon in China? Do we have a chance if they have a different set of rules about patent infringement than we do?
We have maybe I'll take maybe one or two more if there are any more. Otherwise, I'll go down the list.
Then you're going to summarize them.
Yeah. No. Okay, you can each just answer off the top of your head, and I'll tell you what's not answered, and then I'll... So.
let me address this issue about China.
Yeah.
And it's just something that's always a concern because of the patent situation. I think the thing is patents, you never assume you're going to win simply because your company has patents. You just have to build products and serve customers. So it's best if you can patent or trade, have something that's hard to do and you can have a trade secret. But it's never sufficient to really create a significant and sustainable enterprise.
You know, I think a very interesting model we're moving to is, some of you guys won't be very happy with, is technology is becoming more like fashion. If you think about it, there is no intellectual property protection for fashion. The only protection you have is to innovate faster than anybody else. So the ability to do something faster and get it out faster is your survival. Now, you can't copy trademarks and things like this. I mean, there are limitations to what's going on. But that speed of being able to do certain kinds of innovation is a competitive barrier, which I think we're going to have to come back and understand more of. You know, obviously, there are patents for very fundamental breakthroughs that if you want patient capital, have to be there. But we may need kind of a dual-place model to keep in mind.
So... come on, guys. That was only one of the questions.
Oh.
So here are the two biological ones about cloning as the next big thing and about being able to engineer certain high-level skills, you know, through genetic testing of who has them.
That's the second one's sufficiently far over the horizon. I have no idea.
Yeah.
The cloning, I think in farming, you know, kind of, mm-hmm. and farming with a pH, where mm-hmm. in those kinds of areas, if you know people can make. Bacteria or whatever that are used, then cloning of those kinds of things makes a lot of sense. I maybe clone your cat, but beyond that, it's not the science is pretty primitive. It is a little bit like Frankenstein today. Mm-hmm. The number of failures you have mm-hmm. to every success is still pretty awful.
I mean, one of the interesting things about these deep ethical questions is, what are the unintended consequences? And it's very hard to think through what some of those unintended consequences are. So to go to your question a moment, back it off a little bit. You know, with the genomic analysis you're talking about, what happens when you try to get insurance? I mean, basically, if everyone has their own private genome understood, that's going to, you know, affect the way you get insurance, but insurance actually works by grouping people. Well, everyone is separate now. So there are going to be some very interesting issues of how does this affect.
It's also going to affect marriages.
May already.
To the question about, you know, kind of advanced technology weapons of mass destruction in the hands of people who are at, say, a different, operating by different rules than we are, whether they're medieval kind of beliefs or, you know, what we won't consider the same thing. I mean, that's a big problem. And, you know, it's one that Ken Wilber has written about. I mean, we have to get ourselves through a different, we have to go through mental development to be able to coexist safely with some of these technologies. And I think also in the United States, you know, that comes home to us because, you know, we don't believe in the theory of evolution and all this. I mean, we have, our education system has failed us, and our ability to separate the two magisteria, to use Stephen Jay Gould's phrase. And we're not coping with being science literate in this age which requires it.
And I think, Anne, instead of answering your particular question, we might actually look at one of the suggestions here in the last couple of days at the Aspen Institute. You know, maybe the problem is that kind of separation. And if we actually institute a national service for everyone, and have everyone have now a set of common experiences, that problem would, by definition, go away. The weapons of mass destruction was still here, but not the particular twist that you actually did. And in terms of you know, a very interesting idea came up here yesterday that argued that for any student that gets a PhD in this country that comes from outside the United States, they ought to be instantly granted a green card so that they can at least stay seamlessly in this country if we can keep them here.
The number of Indian entrepreneurs,
right?
The number of Indian entrepreneurs and people educated in the higher education system in India in our ventures is just
awesome,
stunning.
Right. So this leads to importing the passion via immigration, which you're in favor of. Importing the passion by getting rid of reality TV and making everybody read The Atlantic. You're supporting both.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And
I like the
maybe
Atlantic.
Your uncle.
I like The Atlantic because it often makes me mad, which means it's worth reading.
And flow of VC capital to India and China?
It's happening.
So with that, thank you all for your excellent questions. Thanks to our panel.